You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Although it may not seem so for the next few minutes, this is The Space Show. Yes, 50 years ago, in 1967, this happened. Album was released in 1967, 50 years ago. Its release was marked by 5 pages plus a cover plus an editorial in Time magazine and 4 pages plus a cover of Life magazine. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on Mission Control we have Jay. Now, something else happened 50 years ago. A group of students at Melbourne University were celebrating because they had just delivered to the United States the first satellite ever built in Australia. More about that later in the show. Well, still to come on this evening's The Space Show, we will have part two of our 3-episode series marking the 50th anniversary of the delivery to the United States of the first satellite ever built in Australia. This tale will likely leave you gobsmacked. Welcome to part two of our story of Australis Oscar V, the first satellite ever to be built in Australia. On this evening's The Space Show, we explore why, although delivered 50 years ago this week, it was another 2.5 years before it was launched into space. That launch happened on 1970, January the 23rd. Before that, let's listen in on a question and answer session held at the Final Frontier Festival. This festival was organised at Melbourne University by the Melbourne Space Program Group. Owen Mace was a member of the Australis Oscar V team at Melbourne University in the 1960s. A member of the audience wanted to know why Oscar V was beaten into space 2 years before by the government-built Resat 1.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about some of the things that happened that made you think that, the government might have been keeping rather a closer eye on what you were doing than you would expect for a bunch of students and enthusiasts and amateurs.
Well, of course, these bunch of, for God's sake, undergraduate students, well, and graduate students, what would they know? And I'm talking about people in the weapons research establishment in Salisbury, which you probably don't know, is north of a little Victorian regional country town called Adelaide, where I live, in fact. And they were established after the war for weapons testing at Woomera and so on, weapons research establishment. And they must have thought, for God's sake, there's a bunch of wacky students at, where is it? Melbourne Uni, for goodness sake. We better do something about it. This is a story for conspiracy theorists amongst us, by the way. We were sitting up in our little garret in the physics building. One day, telephone goes off. We apparently had a telephone. Amazing stuff. And so I picked it up, and very embarrassed lady on the other side of the other end of the telephone said, "I'm from the establishment, and I'd like to ask you questions about your satellite." Fine, okay. So, told her about it, and I asked questions and told her what she wanted to know. The very next day, Resat was announced. Now, RESAT was a satellite built by Weapons Research Establishment and launched from Woomera some time later, before, in fact, Australis was launched. That's right. While we were sitting in Lance Jenner's garage, that's right. There's a good conspiracy story for you, and I guarantee that it's true, maybe. That was the story. Australis was still the first spacecraft built in this country. Yes, quite so, quite so. Richard's got a question.
People often ask about those antennas that the aerials that are on Steve's model, about what they were made of. The answer's very simple.
And if you look closely at the pictures, you can still see the numbers on them.
Jan's right, exactly. We got them from the Stanley people who made tape measures, and they said to us, we're sorry, but because of the manufacturing process, we have to leave the inches and feet as they then were on the tape. So they were the one, they were wrapped around the satellite, as you saw on the pictures, and when it was released into orbit, they just sprung out by themselves and had their own, you know, they supported themselves, and they worked a treat.
They did.
And we used them for 10 missions after that.
Used for 10 missions after that, so there you go. You know, nice, simple Aussie solution, isn't it? Questions? Come on, guys and girls. Yes?
What does OSCAR stand for?
Orbiting Satellite Carrying Amateur Radio.
Orbiting Satellite Carrying Amateur Radio.
That'd be the last question.
Last question, okay.
Thank you very much. You are talking about space language, which is not easily understood by me. I want to find out from you, your successful launch, what does it mean to Australia, and what is meant for yourselves?
Oh, okay. It was launched from the United States, Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And that's a terrific question, by the way, the second bit of it. What did it mean? Well, it meant different things to each person. There are so many stories. How many hours have we got here to finish this off with stories and what it meant to us?
Probably not hours.
And I could, you really could go on and on. I think for me, personally, it was the fun and the satisfaction of doing this thing, which we didn't think was particularly amazing at the time. You know, let's do this fun thing, let's get on with it. One thing I will say is we had an extraordinary number of friends. Jan, that we didn't know, of course, at that stage, was one, but also the NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, senior scientific representative in Australia, Mr. Wilson Hunter, was an extraordinary friend and mentor for us, and I suspect that he pushed a lot more than we will ever know.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you for your time, and thank you for sharing such amazing stories and your expertise and your experiences. And it's certainly very inspirational to us at, here at the Melbourne Space Program, and I'm sure many other people in this room. So please, everyone, join me in thanking them once again.
During the late 1960s and early 1970s, Jan King was an engineer at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. At the Final Frontier Festival, he described the negotiations that led to the launch of OSCAR V. Oh, and listen out for our space show World First as Jan recites a satirical song.
My name's Jan King, and I am almost an Australian. I call Australia my home. I live in Noosa in Queensland, and somebody has to live there. We'll soon be, I think, an Australian citizen. But at the time, I lived in Washington, D.C., and all these events, you know, when Marconi sent the first message in Morse over the Atlantic, it was, "What hath God wrought?" And I think that the messages may be appropriate here because this really started something not only in Australia but in America too. So what I'd like to do is share with you. I talk too much. It's a known fact. So the first presentation will be kind of a silent presentation. I'll annotate it occasionally. So this is not only about Australis Oscar, but what happened as a result of Australis Oscar, and it won't take very long. We sort of talked about then just the evolution of things, but what you really need to understand is the politics of what happened, because it got really very interesting over on the other side when this thing actually arrived. So let's zoom way out and look at the big picture. The big picture is that we're looking at just not just any old time in the history of spaceflight. We're looking at the time in spaceflight. We are smack dab in the center of the Apollo era. Not only that, I didn't know this till the other day when I analyzed it, but we were exactly between the launch of Apollo 12 and the launch of Apollo 13. Now, raise your hand if you don't know what Apollo 13 was. Okay, you have to go look on the net, and your homework assignment is to go figure out what it is, and then you go watch the movie about Apollo 13. Okay, so the people who made the decision, who said, yes, let's launch Australis Oscar V, were none other than the administrator of NASA and the two highest level satellite associate administrators, one for science and one for applications. They said yes. They're not worrying about piggyback satellites. They're not worrying about weather satellites, which we flew with. They were spending 95% of their time trying to figure out the last details of what science was going to be put on the moon and how to save the lives of astronauts who were going to deploy those instruments on the moon. Okay, so we put that in perspective and we ask the question, those people who said yes, in the face of a lot of lower level managers saying, don't do this, they said yes in light of what was oncoming at them. And would they have made that same yes decision had, say, the ITOS spacecraft had a little problem with its camera or the Delta with its solid rocket motors and moved that launch, say, 90 days to the right? Would they have still said yes? Think about that. So to put the things in perspective here, at this point in the way things were in the world, Delta launch vehicle is becoming the workhorse for the launch vehicle industry. It was launching almost all the NASA spacecraft, a lot of other commercial satellites, and a few foreign satellites as well. The Delta program was at Goddard Space Flight Center. That's where I was working. The Delta was changing fast. Every few missions, they'd add something to the vehicle. They'd make it bigger. They'd make it more capable. Despite those changes, it was still a 92% reliable launch vehicle. And to set the perspective, Delta had launched all the prior Tyros weather satellites. And this is really a mission about weather satellites. Now, in the meantime, the U.S. weather program had been highly successful. It had been based at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, but it was moved to a new organization that was very quickly changed from ESA to NOAA. So it was a new agency that was responsible for meteorological satellites, and they were to become operational. The first satellite in the new series was going to be called Tyros-M, so it retained the old name when it was on the ground, but it was going to be called the Improved Tyros Operational Satellite in Orbit, ITOS-1. And this spacecraft was a vastly improved technology platform that was capable of doing operational weather forecasting, which was a major step forward. To set the scene again, the players in the Australis Oscar game then at that point was Project Australis from the University of Melbourne. And the only organization I'm sure you would have interfaced with at the time would have been WIA, the Wireless Institute of Australia, who would have advised you to use amateur radio frequencies to do this. So the spacecraft was sent in 1966, 1967, to Project Oscar. Now, Project Oscar was an amateur radio group, not-for-profit also, and all those guys worked at Lockheed Space and Missile Systems Group, and they were quietly, because you didn't talk about these things in those days, building spy satellites. The system is called Corona. It's now an open system, and you can actually see Corona pictures, but at the time, highly classified. That was kind of a bit of a sphincter factor here for the continuing ongoing program, because while you're launching secondary spacecraft coming from other countries, you're putting them on the aft end of one of the most secure things that's happening in America. And so the Oscar guys were having a little bit of trouble kind of sort of paving the way to do this. In the meantime, several of us formed AMSAT, the Radio Amateur Satellite Corporation, in Washington, D.C., but that did not happen until 1968, and by the time we could do anything, it was 1969. So this spacecraft is sort of sitting there in Australia, and it had been moved to a garage in Sunnyvale, California, where it sat, and then later we were able to convince others that it should be moved to Washington, D.C., where later on it was made a part of the Delta launch. Our interface was with the American Radio Relay League and the International Amateur Radio Union were involved in the radio licensing, but AMSAT formed a relationship, of course, with NASA Goddard Space Flight Center and NASA headquarters. I was working at the time at Goddard Space Flight Center for NASA as a sort of junior engineer. And then, of course, we have the whole NOAA stack of people that were involved. And the Tyros project, while it was done for NOAA, it was done at NASA at Goddard. So the program, the project office was at Goddard, as was the Delta project office. So, we, again, trying to set the stage, what we forced upon the system was a spacecraft that wasn't expected, and what NASA and NOAA hadn't counted on was the sheer determination, the can-do attitude of the Delta people in the Delta Project Office, who became my very best friend, as you could well imagine. And they also didn't expect the amateur radio mafioso. AMSAT at the time was mostly 22-year-old testosterone combined with 50-year-old wisdom and perspective in a very real sense, Washington, D.C. perspective, a group of guys who not only wanted to do it, they wanted to do it badly, and they knew how. So we had infiltrated, before we even started, every major organization we needed to. For example, the director of Goddard Space Flight Center, the highest level manager of that center, was a radio amateur. The guy who was running the NOAA program office for satellites, Jack Townsend, was a radio amateur. The guys we had to have circulate the paperwork within NASA headquarters were radio amateurs. The people we had to deal with at the Federal Communications Commission were like five times radio amateurs. We had them coming out of the woodwork at the FCC. The game that we were then playing that you have to sort of now appreciate is we had one group who'd put a lot of work into this from Australia, and with support through the Australian embassy and other forces in Washington, applying subtle pressure, saying, look, can you help these guys get this done? We had a young group of people who were both engineers and well-connected people in Washington who were radio amateurs that also wanted to get this done. We created this incredible organization. We had incredible goals, and we actually were trying, and we did achieve a lot of those goals. We took this spacecraft literally under our arm and set it on a desk in the Delta Project office, and before we knew it, we had a whole group of friends at the Delta Project who said, yep, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. Delta wants to be there for everyone. They want to do it, and they want it to be international. Improve that the launch vehicle they had every time they had an opportunity, and sometimes they made those opportunities. The international customers were important to them. Commercial customers were very important to them, and secondary payloads were important to them. On the other hand, NOAA had some issues too. they were very successful and had proved that now we can actually use these satellites in forecasting, major breakthrough. They wanted to be able to do this, and they didn't really want a lot of things to get in the way of this new technology they were about to demonstrate. Delta was trying to improve the launch vehicle more than they needed to get this mission done. And on top of that, they'd added this ham radio secondary payload to the aft end, and they were not entirely happy about that. So, again, trying to put things in perspective, these deltas you see here all happened. They all existed at one point in time. That great big thing exists today and is hardly ever used because it's too darn expensive. No surprises there. Putting it in perspective, we were working down in that little bitty rocket down on the left-hand side, and all they wanted to do was go from three caster two solids at the bottom to six. That was the issue. That was the whole issue. So the game is on. The satellite was sitting in Lance Jenner, the project manager, Oscar's garage. AMSAT did all the appropriate things to move forward and try and formally and informally request a launch. And so we pushed the button. We approached the administrator of NASA. We did all the right things we had to do there. At the same time, the Delta Project Office assisted us and agreed to build up the separation system that had to be built on the other side of the interface, the launch vehicle side of the interface, to separate the spacecraft. But we had to build the parts. That was partly a government, U.S. government rule. You couldn't build hardware for somebody who was volunteering things. You couldn't waste government taxpayers' money on these things, so it had to be built by us. So we did that. And very shortly after all this happened, we had our first meeting between the Delta Project Office, who was presenting us, Australis and AMSAT, to Goddard, and we had the meeting with the Tyros project manager, Ed Goddard. And after listening to my technical presentation, Bill Jones, the project manager, says, I have three answers for you regarding this spacecraft. And he said, and you can pick whichever one of those answers you really like. That's fine with us. But no, hell no, and never. Well, fortunately, we didn't listen to him and pressed on. At NASA headquarters, Dick Daniels and Perry Klein, two of our senior managers, obtained approval signature from the Deputy Associate Administrator for Space Science. That was Dr. Dick Marston. The Delta Project Office, jumping the gun just a little bit, then went to Douglas Aircraft and said, okay, guys, modify the vehicle, build the hardware for this. We think it's going to happen. And they did it on spec by a month or two. AMSAT, with the help of Marston, then persuaded Thomas Paine, the Administrator of NASA, to sign a letter authorizing us to go. The authorization, however, was contingent upon the approval of the NOAA project over there, and the launch was to be free to AMSAT. So this launch actually cost nothing for the public, if you will, for this event to happen. By the way, just for your general edification, this is going to be on camera, so I guess I have to say it's public. About $120,000 to $130,000 is roughly what that contract would have been worth from NASA to Douglas to put this thing on there. NOAA head of satellite programs, Jack Townsend, agrees. Of course, remember, another plant, he's a ham. He agreed, but he did what I thought was very reasonable. He said it's contingent upon you guys doing a whole bunch of things. And he had a laundry list of things we had to do. And they were all very reasonable things, and we set about doing it. So what that really meant is by that time we could actually roll up our sleeves and actually do something. So we refurbished the satellite, replaced the battery, built that separation system that Delta asked us to, and environmentally tested this spacecraft. And that was one of the most brutal vibration tests I've ever seen, because we were mounted, remember, only a half a meter from the second stage engine. So imagine the acoustic levels we would have seen at that position. It was pretty bad. Glad to say we never had to fly back there again. We completed the list of constraints. The ITOS project then reluctantly agreed to fly Australis Oscar A, clearing the way for the launch. And this is the list of firsts that this system accomplished. Then the next relevant event, and this is sort of now, you would love to be in a position where this event occurs. There is a formal T-minus 3-day review at the launch site. All participants are there. We're there taking part. And the ITOS project manager said yes, the Delta project manager said yes, and the center director of Goddard said yes. So that meant we're going. The launch of ITOS and Australis Oscar 5 was completely successful. The PMAS system worked great. In fact, the magnet captured in about 2 days, and the spacecraft sat there and just spun down exactly what it should have done. It did exactly that. And we have all that from the sun sensors, and it worked just great. So it completed its mission after 46 days. There was more to this story behind the scenes than I knew. And how do I know that? Because of the party. The Delta guys worked hard, but they partied even harder. So they decided, as they often did, but not always did, to have a party in this occasion, because it was a bonding event between NOAA and NASA. NOAA is a new agency, brand new weather satellite system, modified Delta rocket. It all worked. And there was another little thing, that secondary satellite worked really, really well. So among those invited were the people you've already heard about. The NASA administrator did not attend, but the two deputy associate administrators, Glenn Jaffe and Dick Marston, did attend. The center director was there, and Dr. Jack Townsend, the associate administrator for meteorological satellite problems, the other big ham, was there. And as well as all of the Delta dignitaries that were involved. Also invited were the AMSAT team, and myself and Dr. Perry Klein attended, along with Dick Daniels, who'd worked the paperwork all the way through headquarters, and another gentleman named Harry Helfrich, who was a very helpful guy. So, John Tomasello, who was the second tier. He was our mission integration manager. He worked directly with me to do all the hardware and make sure everything got integrated in the proper order on the vehicle. He disappeared for a few days, and Bob Goss, the head of mission integration, had sent him over to the machine shop where he built about 24 of these, which is a little model of Oscar there, and a little inscription, and of course, notice the shape, it's a Delta. So they got all the politically right stuff in there. And this is what the base looks like. You can come up and have a look at this after. It says, Delta 76, the launch of Oscar A, and Tyros M. I'm really, really very sorry that I don't have a picture of Bob Goss, because he's the hero of our story, the head of mission integration. He's the one who took all the political headwind here and who pushed forward. But I did have a picture of John Tomasello. John became a friend of mine after that. And we were best friends until he died in about 1993. Very big. If it hadn't been for this gentleman, you guys probably wouldn't have gotten up there. Okay, so Bob Goss never wanted to miss the opportunity for social satire. And the way I know that this was discussed at higher levels within NASA is because of the generation of this song. Bob didn't pull out the four flushers unless something important had happened. And I never, ever thought I would have a song sung about something that I did. So this was a group of people who sang in five-part harmony called the Four Flushers. So you have a quintet called the Four Flushers. Don't ask me. The toilet language is something. See me offline. It was a big thing for the Delta thing. there's a lot of stories there. This song wasn't up to Banjo Patterson standards, what I would say is it nonetheless told beautifully the story of what had happened really during that year when Tyros was approached by the upstart Australis. And I think you've all heard the song before. So it was to the tune of A Bicycle Built for Two. So it goes, Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage, I can't afford a carriage. But you'll look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two. Now it turns out that Daisy was a bit Edwardian. It turns out she was actually the real Daisy was a distant relative of Edward VII of England. So if it sounds, her response sounds a little bit Edwardian, I think we can forgive her for that. Henry, Henry, this is my answer true. I'm not crazy over the likes of you. If you can't afford a carriage, forget about the marriage. I won't be jammed, I won't be crammed on a bicycle built for two. Now, Mr. Goss commissioned the Four Flushers to sing the song on this evening, and this is the song that he proposed. The first verse is from the Tyros project manager singing to me. Who was, nobody in the audience could have been more surprised than that. So he's singing to the project manager, Oscar. Oscar, Oscar, give me your answer do. I'm unwilling to share my ride with you. You'll probably block my vision or cause a space collision. So I'll be damned if I'll be crammed on a vehicle built for two. Next verse. Now the Oscar project manager sings back to the Tyros project manager. Tyros, Tyros, here's my reply to you. I'm approved by NASA HQ, so don't be unkind or bossy with this hitchhiking Aussie, and I'll look neat in the rumble seat of a vehicle built for two. Third verse, Tyros, very frustrated, now turns to the Delta project and says, my recourse, what am I going to do? Delta, Delta, here's all I have to say. If he bumps me, there will be hell to pay. Six solids we could not prevent. This ham adds to our torment. We never thought that we'd get caught on a vehicle built for two. Now the punchline. Delta responds to the Tyros program. Tyros, Tyros, not a thing can go wrong. Be a hero, let Oscar tag along. And be a content precursor, it could have been much worser. We could, you see, have carried three on this vehicle built for two. And as though this was for telling the future. 4 years later, 28 Delta rockets later, 7 ITOS spacecraft later, and 2 Oscar satellites later, we have ITOS 7, Intelsat, a Spanish spacecraft, taking this number 2 position, and the number 3 position is taken by AMSAT Oscar 7, now the longest living spacecraft in orbit, period. And the University of Melbourne was part of that. Program note here, about this time, which was, remember, 4 years later, there was a new ITOS project manager. He'd been the deputy project manager technical, and he'd been my worst nightmare, my nemesis. He was the guy who was overlooking our spacecraft. Whenever it came to the launch site, he'd look in the box, he'd look at it, he'd make sure that nothing was going to fail. He'd go talk to everybody in the background, he'd come back and ask questions. He had been a nightmare for me. But he was now the project manager for Bill Jones had gone away, another project manager. Then Jerry Burdett took over that management. He came up to me at this point. We're closing the fairing. Remember, this is a sacred moment for any aerospace engineer. Your spacecraft disappears when that second fairing half goes on. You never will ever see it again. And you've been living with this box for 5 years, and all of a sudden it disappears to your face. So I'm here having this religious moment, and along comes Jerry Burdett, and he puts his arm on my shoulder, and he says, King, that's a mighty nice spacecraft you've got there. I hope it works well. And he meant it. 2 months later, after the successful launch, Jerry became a radio amateur and he joined AMSAT. He became an AMSAT member. True story. So I guess that really does say, well, if you can't beat him, join him. And speaking of joining, at this very point also, I joined the Delta Project team and went to work for Bob Goss, because anybody who could do this kind of stuff, it was so cool, I just had to be a part of it. So for 4 years, I roamed the world integrating large spacecraft and small spacecraft to the Delta launch vehicle, which was growing in performance every day. I have a closing statement. I have a closing statement to make. So let's now try and address the moment. So our hero Bob Goss of Delta delivered his message. The NASA luminaries thought they were coming to a party to hear about weather satellites. But what they got from the Delta Project in good humor was a message. We got your baby up there and put it where you wanted it. We proved to the world that our modified rocket still works. And wait, there will be more. We did our bit to help start the next generation of aerospace engineers who will replace us all. But we can do even more, and we can do even better. Trust us. And, oh, what are we waiting for? And here's the message from Bob Goss and the Delta team to Australia, coming at you from 45 years in the past. When you, once again, try to create a space program, as you are, you can do it. You can do it even better than you think you can. Trust yourselves. No, really trust yourselves. You must develop the next generation of Asturian aerospace engineers, and this time, those should be the engineers that really build satellites. And oh, what are you waiting for? Australia, you have a heavy coin in your pocket. Take it out. It's been there far too long. On one side of this coin, it says risk. But on the other side, it says opportunity. This time, Australia, put that coin on the table, heads up. Leave it there. And if you ever forget which side of that coin is heads, think about the last NASA luminaries who said yes to little Australia's in the face of oncoming Apollo 13. Yes, chance and luck play a role in this. But then think about the outcome of Apollo 13. It wasn't just a movie. Think about the Delta team who said yes in the face of no, hell no, and never. And think about the UNI Melbourne students and the AMSAT engineer that stand before you. We said, let's do it. Australia, take a chance. Thank you.
We are just about out of time, but I just have to thank Jan. Remember, he was a junior engineer, and I reckon he was probably given the job because they knew that he couldn't do it, that he would fail. But he did, and thank you very much indeed for that.
And that was Jan King, a former engineer at the Goddard Space Flight Center. Well, this has been the second of three space show programs marking the 50th anniversary of the delivery of the first built Australian satellite to the United States. Well, to parody the Beatles, who opened our show this evening, I penned the following and shoved it under the nose of legendary Aussie musician Paul O'Gorman and asked for an impromptu performance.
It was 50 years ago today. The Aussies asked the Yanks to play. The launch manifest in style was guaranteed to raise a smile. So may I introduce to you the team you've known for 50 years. Paul, Richard, Owen, Peter, Stephen and Jan.
And you can hear part three of the Australis Oscar 5 story on next week's The Space Show. Finally, on the space show, we got some news about the missing satellites. Yep, unfortunately, they are still missing. Matthew Tetlow of Adelaide says about SUSAT, no, unfortunately, not yet, when I asked him, have you found them? And he said, still working on it. And he said that there are 11 out of the 28 CubeSats that are missing in action, so we are broadening our search. And Andrew Dempster from University of New South Wales gave us the same sort of answer when he said, no, not yet, they haven't found them. Now, do remember that each of these satellites passes within radio range of Melbourne five times a day. Well, you've been listening to The Space Show.
This is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.